Now, Mrs. Angus, perhaps we could start at the very beginning, and you could tell me how you came to Canada.
Oh, as far back as that. Well, my father was in the British Army, and after a variety of service in the Army in various places, he was sent to Asia Minor to be the British Vice Consul at Sivas, which is in the eastern part of the country and fairly near the Persian border. There he met my mother, and before I was born, as their first child, they moved from Sivas to Diyarbakir, which is on the Tigris River. So I lived there for my first 18 months, and after that my father had the choice of remaining in the consular service or returning to the army. And because my mother was again pregnant and conditions were fairly rigorous, though it was a fairly good-sized town and a busy one, he decided to return to Britain. So there we stayed for a year and a half. My sister was born there. My father went out to India as soon as my sister was born, leaving us for a year in Edinburgh. And then we followed to India, where we all lived for 4 years, two in Secunderabad and two in Bombay. And then, my father's health being very much impaired by his service in the Middle East and the Far East, decided to retire early, a little early, and I think he was then about 48, and come out to Canada. And being persuaded in London to come to the most western province, we finally set out in early July in 1909 for Canada, for British Columbia, and landed in the Kettle River Valley, where an irrigated fruitlands experimental project was being started, and a couple of people had already bought irrigated fruitlands, so-called, and my father in the winter of 1909-10 also bought acreage there. Unfortunately, when we first arrived, my father fell ill with Blackwater fever, which was nearly fatal, but my mother was a practical and very intelligent person, and though I was only 7 and a half, I was able to help her a little bit, and she got us moved into a house from a camp where we were tenting on the banks of the Kettle River, and sent out sort of SOS calls all over the place for a doctor, because of course there were no medical facilities at all in that part of the world near us. And a doctor finally did arrive, and my father survived. And early in 1910, my parents started having a house built and the land prepared for planting an apple orchard. Well, so much for my background. I was educated at home by my mother and father until 1913, in the autumn of 1913. And, no, I think 1914. Yes. And, no, 1913. Then I went to Grand Forks and boarded with friends and took my last year of public school and started the first year of high school the year after. Now, my father was recalled to the army. All the retired people were on the reserve of officers. So in 1915, in January, he left for Britain, and after that, his service was on the staff of a general called General Sir Ian Hamilton, who was involved in the tragic Gallipoli campaign. My father went out there on that staff, and in October he was seconded from the staff to take command of the 1st 9th Manchesters, and on October the 19th he was killed while inspecting trenches. So after I had finished 2 years of high school, there were then only three, my mother decided that it was time to abandon the orchard and the house and everything and move down to Vancouver, because during the first year or two of the war, the frosts in that narrow valley killed nearly all the new orchards, and there seemed to be no hope of recouping the investments, and pretty hefty ones for our limited resources. So she packed up everything and we moved down to Vancouver, where I started my matriculation year at King Edward High School. In due course, I entered the University of British Columbia in 1919. And that was the beginning of the most, to me, rewarding and interesting years, as I think it is to most young people. It is the most, obviously, the most growing up years that one has.
Well, what are some of your best memories of UBC?
Well, I can't say that my first year was one of the happiest, because I found it very difficult to get used to lectures. I'd never been taught before by lectures and taking notes and using library, and also to get used to a great many different styles of lecturing, different people, and very many people of my own age about me. But I got through it quite happily and successfully, but I don't remember that particular year as one of particular enjoyment for me. But and also my mother was finding a small house and we were getting settled down, and my sister became ill, and it was altogether quite a difficult year. But the next 3 years were extremely interesting to me. I had made up my mind very early that what I wanted to do was to study English literature. And so I prepared in my third year to become to take the honors course in English language and literature. There had been two graduating classes before I graduated. I graduated in 23 in English, and in 22 and 21 there were a couple of honors students. And I must say that looking back, that all of them have really had outstanding careers, mainly in academic work, and some of them of course went to the United States, some of them remained in Canada. And in my particular group, I think there were perhaps four of us, but only two taking only English and not English combined with history or with some other subject. And I think I was the only woman who did not go on and have an academic career of some sort. But what I did was to get married about 11 months after I graduated. And I graduated in 1923 and was married in the middle of April in 24.
I gather that the academic requirements were quite rigorous.
They were, and I remember after I was married, Dr. Garnet Sedgwick, who was the head of the English department, came and asked me, he said, the faculty is just telling me that our course is too rigorous and that we really ought to trim it down a little bit. What do you think? And I said, well, as far as I'm concerned, it nearly killed me, but then I'm perhaps tougher top of the most. So he looked a little glum and said, well, he would consider cutting it down a bit, which I am glad to say he did.
What exactly did you have to do?
Well, the main objective was to graduate with the BA with first class honors, which was an average of well over 80%. You couldn't get any kind of first class honors without an average of over 80, in which you had a fair knowledge of the whole field of English literature. That meant taking all the courses in English. You were compelled, I think, to take one course, which was outside, and I chose French. And you were supposed to submit on a certain date with no excuses given, and this was a week before the final exams began in your fourth year, a completed graduating essay. You were not allowed to call it a thesis. That was for people doing postgraduate work, not for undergraduates. And this had to be written under the supervision of one of the members of the English department. Oh, that reminds me, all the people in the departments, permanent appointments, who gave the lectures were all the top people. There weren't any juniors. Everybody was a fully fledged professor. And I must say that we got, as for our lectures and supervision for our written work, absolutely the best there was. I don't say that that was the best in the world, but I think most of us thought it was. Anyway, we were usually extremely proud of our professorial staff, and they became friends. They seemed quite old to us, but actually most of them were young married people. But there wasn't a great age gap in age between the undergraduates and the professorial staff, so they actually became lifelong friends. And we felt that sometimes if we didn't get exactly all we needed in our research into the past of English literature, for example, what did that matter? We had a library and we could go look things up. After all, there was no use being too exacting. So really had a very happy time with them. Well, my undergraduate years were from 1919 to the spring of 23. And as I said, I married less than a year after, within less than a year. And about 6 years after that, I became president of the Faculty Women's Club. Now, if you would like me to talk about the Students' Council first, would you like me to do that?
Yes, tell us about your activities in the Student Council. And
yes. Well, the students, as I say before, I don't think I did, that UBC had given it, the undergraduates, student self-government from the very beginning. It was initiated with the university. Now, my husband, who is a graduate of McGill, tells me that McGill didn't achieve student self-government for quite a long time after that.
Were the students aware that this was a bit unusual?
No, I, of course, not knowing anything about any other universities, I wouldn't know, and I don't remember anyone commenting on it. It was taken for granted that students to head different parts of the government of the university for the students, by the students, I mean the Alma Mater Society was the main body, but then there was the arts undergraduate men and the Women's Undergraduate Society, which was the women of arts, because there were very few outside the Faculty of Arts. By the way, there were only three faculties: arts, applied science, and agriculture. And Martha McKechnie was the only young woman in the Faculty of Agriculture, and a very delightful and a very beautiful girl she was. And in the Faculty of Applied Science, there were three women, to begin with, who graduated in my year, who were the first graduates from the first course training nurses with university degrees, and they took a 5-year course, two at within a hospital and 3 at UBC, and they graduated with a degree, the Bachelor of Applied Science in Nursing. That was their degree. And there were three of them. One of them was Beatrice Johnson, who later married Frederick Wood. Well, the Students' Council consisted, I'd have to look it up to make sure, but of about 12 members. And the president of the Students' Council when I was on it was A.E. Richards, AB. And he was chairman of the council meetings. I was named vice chairman because the women's undergrad president was supposed to be. But I never took a council meeting, to my great disgust, because AB Richards was never absent, never. That was sad.
So you were on the Students' Council as representative for the Women's Undergraduate
Society, yes. The council was made up of so many people. Now, I don't remember if I was on in any capacity the year before. If I looked at my annual here, I might have been on, because they had other organizations which I was active in, for the art and scientific organization, you know, looked after the Glee Club and other matters of that sort.
Was there a men's undergraduate society?
Yes, arts men. And then they didn't have to specify the applied science men in science, because there were only the nurses, and they just naturally sort of drifted into the women's undergrad, which had Martha McKechnie from agriculture. So you had the arts men and the applied science and the agriculture undergrads and the women's undergraduate, you see. So there were really four undergraduate groups who were represented. And then you had someone who was president representing the sports and for the women, and a man for the others. I remember Gladys Weld was president of the women, I've forgotten what it was called, the athletic, that's it, the Women's Athletic Association, the Men's Athletic Association. Now,
can you tell me what sort of activities the Students' Council engaged in?
Yes, I think that we felt our responsibilities were great, and our ideals were somewhat grandiose perhaps, but the policy of the whole university in relation not only to ourselves as students concerned us, but we discussed university policy in relation to the public, because we felt that we were fairly close to the public in different parts of the province, and we were very tender of the reputation of UBC, and sometimes we even debated decisions that had been made by the board, and decided occasionally that we didn't go along with that. Perhaps somebody ought to give them a little word of advice.
Did you ever change anyone's mind?
I don't really remember, because my responsibility wasn't as heavy as AB Richards, as I said. We also were much concerned by our own self-discipline within the student body, because in those days the university wasn't well and favorably known by the citizens of Vancouver, because it was very new, and Vancouver was quite young and growing rapidly, and nobody had felt any urgent need for a university at all as far as the town was concerned. So there was quite a gap between the town and Gown, and we were very anxious that nobody should overstep the line that met with public disapproval. We shouldn't, none of that should be permitted, because it damaged our alma mater. So We dealt with those within our own organization. It wasn't anything that concerned the Board of Governors or the President or anybody else. It concerned us. One of the funny things was, I remember, the beginning of my year as president of the women's undergrad, it was brought to my attention that two of the freshmen, two charming young women, were wearing their hair down their backs just as they did when they were at high school. And one of them had beautiful black curly hair, and it was very pretty, but and it made her look extremely young. Well, she was really quite young. And there was a second, too, that wore her hair in braids, I think, down her back. So my executive suggested that I write a polite letter to these two young ladies who were in the first year and tell them that it would be perhaps better if they put their hair up, because after all, we were very anxious to convince everyone who was on the campus that this was no longer a high school. The atmosphere was quite different and our aims were quite different. We were now really grown up. My letter met with some opposition from one of the young ladies, one of the freshmen, who firmly declined to put her hair up, and the other one said her mother wouldn't let her, but she carried hairpins in her bag with her books, and on the streetcar coming to university, she pinned her hair up, which, needless to say, didn't last very long because it kept falling down. This particular young student is still a long time pal and friend of mine. Well, we had to deal with sports, and seeing that everything was properly run and games were played in opposition to other universities and so on and so forth, and also publications. The UBC was editor of the UBC was a member, of course, of council, and what the UBC said and did and how excellent the paper was of course of great interest to us. And we only had one real contretemps, one schmozzle that year with the UBC, which is known as the Newbold incident, but that's something else again, and I won't take up.
Oh, please,
do you want me to?
Yes. Now that you've mentioned it.
Oh dear. Well, Sir Henry Newbold came out to speak, to address the different organizations across Canada, and he was invited to address a mass meeting of students, those who were interested in literature and poetry, and in the auditorium in the old campus at UBC on the General Hospital site. And in the course of his talk, he read some of his own poetry, and one of the poems he read was Drake's Drum. Now, I saw nothing wrong with all this. I was very interested in poetry. In fact, it was my favorite reading, so I remember enjoying this very much. But the next issue of the UBC printed a very clever parody of Drake's Drum, which made fun of it, and lightheartedly and with great expertise. And it was written by a friend of mine who was in the junior year at that time. Well, everybody, including the president of the Alma Mater Society, was deeply and profoundly shocked that a visitor should be treated so impolitely. After all, he was a visitor, and it was just not the thing to make fun of one of his best-known poems. So then everybody took sides, and the Board of Governors and the Chancellor and the President and the UBC, who printed this poem, and all of the rest of us. And this was just at the end of the year, and I could have done without having it a meeting of the Students' Council every single day for a whole week to deal with the New Bolt incident. Well, finally, I gather that everyone, I mean the people who won on the vote, joined together with the board and sent a telegram of apology to Sir Henry Newbolt, who was then in Eastern Canada, who I heard afterwards was extraordinarily puzzled because he didn't know anything about the whole thing at all and would never have heard anything about it if we hadn't been so terribly anxious to apologize to him for what we thought was a most impolite thing to have done. But the net result, which was sad, was that Harry Cassidy, who was editor of the UBC, resigned from his editorship on this matter. And this was just before his graduation. He was in my own class. And so that was really the sad outcome of all this. Now, I think that's really quite enough about the Students' Council. The great achievement of the class of 23 and the classes of 23 and of 24, the freshmen, of course, the following fall hadn't yet been registered, and the first year people were the second year then, and the thirds, they didn't have a great deal of, they did some canvassing, in the great publicity campaign that the students put on in the summer 22. But I think my class, the people in 23, were really the spearhead of this great publicity campaign. It was absolutely necessary, we found, in our final year, since the enrollment at the university on its first campus on the General Hospital grounds was about 1,000 students, 1,000 undergraduates. It was obviously necessary that we were running out of room and we had to be moved. The buildings that had been started before the First World War were still standing unfinished at Point Grey. The undergraduates decided that a publicity campaign to have the university moved must be put on. Well, this was put on and organized very well. It was entirely an undergraduate affair. The people on the speakers committee stumped the whole province. The campaign committee got to work in midsummer, and the rest of us all stumped up whatever we could in the way of donations to finance it. But the main point to remember is that it was entirely an undergraduate student push, and that it was enormously successful, that the petitions circulated through the whole province were massive in bulk when they were all put together, and that Jack Klein and some of his committee members, he was one of the moving spirits in this, went to Victoria and presented the petition on the floor of the legislature, and they were met with great interest and kindliness, and their demands were acceded to very quickly. And so in October, what is called now the Great Trek took place, which was the victory march from the old campus and all the way out to the new one.
And did you take part in the Great Trek?
No, because I was unfortunately laid low with influenza at that time. I wasn't able to. But my husband did. He walked all the way from the old campus to the new.
Good for him.
Right.
Do you think that the publicity campaign improved relations with the city of Vancouver at all?
Yes.
Sort of developed some rapport between the city and the university?
I do think so, because we had in one of the newspapers, The Province, with Dr. S.D. Scott as the editor, we had a very powerful friend. He was a splendid governor of the university. He was extremely kind, to in entertaining students and new members of staff, and they got a great deal of publicity and help through Dr. Scott, and I think it did improve. It brought the university, for example, to the attention of the general public, and of course the floats and the banners and so on were extremely cleverly done, and a lot of people turned out to see them on that occasion. Now, should I now speak of the Faculty Women's Club?
Yes.
Are you all set? Just to leave my undergraduate years, which I really think were outstanding looking back from the age of 75, I think were certainly the most interesting, enjoyable in some ways, and poignant in others, the most enjoyable years of my life, because one was growing up, and so many people that have remained my friends for the whole of my life, I got to know then. And in those days, one made friends young and kept them for a long time, and it's a great pleasure and support. I know it sounds a little hackneyed, but I think a quotation of two of Wordsworth's lines does sum up what most of us felt. Bliss was it in that dawn to be alive, but to be young was very heaven. Well, I became engaged shortly after I graduated, and 6 years after my marriage, to my surprise, I was elected to the presidency of the Faculty Women's Club. Before that, I wasn't a very regular attendant at the meetings because I was getting used to being a housekeeper, a housewife, and I had two small children, but certainly the meetings that I went to were very pleasant. They were held in the homes of the different members. When I joined it soon after I was married, were in the houses of the members, and the atmosphere was very, very pleasant and congenial. I think the main impression that the club gave, and I think it was the one it wished to give to new members, it was a happy, pleasant social experience in which we got to know other people whose husbands were all engaged in the same interesting type of work. The entertainment, apart from short business meetings, the entertainment consisted of someone playing the piano or singing a few songs to us, or putting on one or two skits, I remember quite well, and at other meetings there were dramatic readings. Beatrice Wood, who was then the wife of the founder of the Players Club, and after whom the Freddie Wood Theatre is named, writes to me that she did quite a lot of readings for the club meetings in those days, and particularly at Christmas time, and she remembers reading the part of St. Joan in Shaw's St. Joan, the play, and apart from that, she can't remember very much about the programs. Another thing that the members of the Faculty Women's Club were particularly interested in and hoped to be active in were these things were to do with helping the new Dean of Women. Mary Bollett was, Dr. Bollett was the first Dean of Women, and we were very anxious to help her in any way we could, and help her with a fund to assist women students who perhaps didn't have quite enough money to finish their courses and that sort of thing. And there was that fund, and also the club was active in raising an endowment for the Anne Westbrook Scholarship Fund in honor of the widow of the first president of the infant UBC. This money raising, I think we would all recognize as traditional with women's groups of this kind. You persuaded someone to give you a lecture, usually someone from the faculty, and then you sold tickets to the lecture, and then you bought or made nice refreshments and served them. And most of the people who attended were the university family anyway, so really it was all in the family. But I noticed that that is so with many things still, with larger, more modern organizations. But in that particular simple and easy fashion, they managed to pay out a scholarship of at least $100 a year at that time. My memories of the club, of the Faculty Women's Club, are very happy ones. It was a very friendly place, and there I made some very, very great friends. People sometimes older than I, but people whom I liked very much and who were most helpful. I think among the ones I remember best were people whom one might call characters. The treasurer, Minnie Jordan, Mrs. Jordan, was one of them. She had a firm hold on the purse strings, I remember. And when I was president of the club in 30 and 31, sometimes I felt that we might be a little more generous in one type of expenditure than usual, but Mrs. Jordan was always a little reluctant. But she would look at me in what I might call a mini Tory way, if I may make a silly pun, her name being Minnie. But years and years afterwards, after Mrs. Jordan's death, Alice Spencer, Mrs. George Spencer, who was a member of in those early days of the club, said to me, "Did I ever tell you that when you were elected to be president of the faculty club, faculty women's club, I said to Mrs. Jordan," and she quoted some rather flattering remark like, don't you think that our new president is the prettiest president we've had so far?" Mrs. Jordan looked her in the eye and said firmly, "I do not."
But she didn't digress.
No, she didn't explain. No, that was, at least if she did, Alice didn't know. And then Lynette Boving, Mrs. Paul Boving, was a delightful person who was coach of the women's grass hockey team and honorary president of the Women's Athletic Association. I don't know if she had been the games mistress in an English girls' school, a good boarding school, but she gave one that impression. She was like that. She was like an excellent and popular games mistress in a girls' school. And then there was Mrs. Coleman, whose husband, Dean Coleman, was dean of the Faculty of Arts. And at least they came while I was in the middle of my undergraduate course. Mrs. Coleman took a kindly interest in the welfare of the women students and of the younger faculty wives, perhaps just a little bit too much of an interest. You know, one felt it was almost a grandmotherly interest, perhaps, sometimes. And I remember in at least one occasion when a new young person like myself was first in the chair, as president of the Faculty Women's Club, and she was struggling a little bit with shyness and the agenda, a firm but kindly voice from the back of the drawing room said, "Oh, no, no, dear, you mustn't do it that way. You should say this and this." Well, Dr. McGinnis was an occasional attendant at Faculty Women's Club meetings, because the women members of staff did come occasionally, though not very often. And she, I came to understand and admire very much. She had a hard Rota Ho is at the beginning as the only woman on the faculty. And that perhaps inclined her to be a little definite and brusque and downright. But as this often does, this manner concealed a very kindly and very sensitive person. And I remember the late Isabel McGuinness with much affection. Mrs. Walker, Frances Walker's wife, Eleanor, was old enough to be my mother, and I think in fact, she was a sort of surrogate mother to me when I was young. But she was a very, very charming and delightful and humorous person, and I remember her too with much affection. Mary Bollett was the dean, the first dean of women, and she was interested and kindly and competent and well-informed, and I don't think I ever heard anyone say anything derogatory, unkind, or critical of Miss Bollett. She was an excellent dean of women. Mrs. Brock was really a very distinguished person. She and Dean Brock, who was dean of applied science, were killed in a tragic air crash of a small flight plane, light plane, at Alta Lake. It crashed into the lake just immediately after takeoff, and she was indeed a great loss to Vancouver as a whole, I think. Well, I've covered, unless you have some questions to ask me, I think that, except for saying that my happy memories are of kindly, simple, well-intentioned group of people. I mean, it wasn't pretentious, it didn't put on airs. It was sincerely interested in being kind and helpful to undergraduates and to new people on the staff.
How did the men feel about the Faculty Women's Club?
Well, I think as well brought up husbands do, they thought it was a good idea. They felt that yes, it was fine. But of course there are always some mavericks, some smarty pants, you know, who say slightly derogatory things. And I did get the impression that some of the younger and what shall I say, more sarcastic people considered us as perhaps a sort of well-intentioned ladies' aid type of organization, but I think that was unkind and quite unjustified.
Didn't your husband have a story or something about the Faculty Women's Club? What was that he told us last week?
What did he say? What was it about?
I can't remember.
Well, I can't remember either. We'll have to get it from him another time.